Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the terrorist attacks in Kenya and Pakistan that targeted Christians and non-Muslims, and look into the increasingly dangerous environment for humanitarian and aid organizations as they try to address the underlying problems that cause states to fail and then become havens for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. James Jennings, the president of Conscience International, joins us to discuss the growing challenges of operating in Somalia and Pakistan. And then we'll speak with Flint Leverett, who served as a senior director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council and is the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We'll discuss possible diplomatic openings between the U.S. and Iran as world leaders meet at the United Nations to address the General Assembly and to find a way to proceed on the Russian-American framework for controlling and destroying Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. Then finally, we'll speak with Michael Cohen, a columnist for the UK Guardian and a former chief speechwriter for the United States representative at the United Nations. We will discuss the role that Samantha Power now has representing the United States and how behind-the-scenes and backroom deals can be arranged and orchestrated between heads of states not on speaking terms who need to address common challenges. And joining us now is James Jennings, founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 and 2011 in the refugee camps on the Ethiopian-Somali border, as well as in the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed at a bombing at the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. Since founding Conscience International in 1991, he has demonstrated his conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Jennings.
Thank you.
And it seems to me that given the sectarian nature of these two outrageous attacks in the mall in Nairobi, where Al-Shabaab terrorists yelled out to everybody, all the Muslims stand up, and gave them safe passage out. And then one of the Al-Shabaab turned to an Indian gentleman and asked him the name of the Prophet Muhammad's mother, and the man couldn't answer the question, so he was shot dead at point-blank range. And then, of course, you have the bombing of the church in Peshawar, Pakistan, that killed 85 people, and it's outraged the Christian minority community there. So there's no question that there's sectarian nature to a lot of this bloodshed, but how do you get around this conundrum where it's increasingly dangerous for you and other humanitarian aid organizations to work in countries like Somalia and Pakistan to address the underlying problems that cause these states to become failed states and then become havens for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda? So that seems to me a vicious circle.
It is indeed, and I think you've put it very well, that in fact it's the horns of a dilemma. It's very difficult to work under those circumstances, and yet that's where the need is greatest, and the call to do something is most pressing. So I think I understand how people react to these kinds of events, as horrific as they are and as dramatic as they are. It seems to me, though, that it is helpful to get some greater context to what is going on. Usually, after the situation subsides, one can go in and continue to do the work. The situation in Pakistan in particular was relevant because I've been to that church, and I have people working there now in that whole area around Peshawar. And during the time that I was there, and it's been a couple of years ago now, there was a huge explosion in the central market of Peshawar, and 134 people died. We were scheduled to be there that day, but instead we worked outside the city. A few days after we left, there was another explosion exactly where we had been working. So I can just reiterate that, supporting your point, that it's very dangerous to work there.
And Somalia is, of course, for all intents and purposes, a failed state. And the Al-Shabaab terrorists who took over the mall in Nairobi and held it for 3 days, They have obviously taken credit for what they're doing and said it's in response to the 4,000 Kenyan troops that it was sent in under a African force financed by the United States to drive al-Shabaab out. So what's happening on the ground in terms, can you work in Somalia?
It's possible, and there are flights that go in to Mogadishu intermittently from centers in the area, from Uganda and from Kenya and from Ethiopia. So it is possible to go there, and there are people working there now. However, it's increasingly difficult. The Harakat al-Shabaab Mujahideen, which is we call al-Shabaab, is really a an offshoot or a youth militia of the Islamic Courts Union, which was in power in Mogadishu and in Kismayu, in southern part of the country, back a few years ago. They, however, were insistent on a Sharia, strict Sharia law interpretation, and gained a lot of support for the opposition in Somalia and those countries round about by the U.S. and Ethiopia and Kenya agreeing to a policy of removing those people from power. But the youth militia, al-Shabaab, is still continuing. So when Kenya invaded, when Ethiopia invaded, then things changed on the ground in Somalia. But there is certainly retaliation for that, and this is one of those acts.
But the intervention by Ethiopia happened back in the George W. Bush administration, and that was organized by the Bush administration as a way, they thought, to stabilize Somalia. But these countries are long-time enemies, and it did nothing but make the situation worse. I mean, the Kenyan intervention happened more recently.
That's right. And in 2010-11, at the same time that the famine was taking so many victims, about 260,000 people died of the famine, according to the United Nations, and there were 2 million people displaced by that, and we worked during that period of time in all around that area. But I think that what's interesting is that the Obama administration has followed the militaristic response of the Bush administration in setting up AFRICOM, AFRICOM it's called, and developing a strategy for combating terrorism. But strategy for combating terrorism always has to be a military strategy, and that seems to have the opposite effect. It creates more, as in northern Pakistan, for example, more resistance. The more drone strikes, the more people are killed, the more resistance there is. And I think in East Africa, it's very much the same. So that's what I mean by the horns of a dilemma. You have to do something to counter these kinds of acts. And yet, the more you do, the more response there is from the other side.
And again, I'm speaking with James Jennings, the founder and president of Conscious International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 and 11 in the refugee camp on the Ethiopian-Somali border, as well as the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed by a bombing of the by suicide bombings of the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. And since founding Conscious International in 1991, he has demonstrated conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. Now, James, clearly the war on terror is an absurdity and a catastrophe, and it's totally counterintuitive and counterproductive. You can't have a war on a tactic. That doesn't make any sense. But what drives the Al-Qaeda and the Al-Shababs is a very identifiable ideology. And it guess where it comes from Saudi Arabia, from the Wahhabi version of Islam. And the Saudis have poured a ton of money into Pakistan, and they've destabilized that place. They've created the Taliban, and when it was in government, along with Pakistan, the only country that supported them. And they continue to fund these radical organizations in Pakistan. I don't know whether they funded the people that blew up the church, but it wouldn't be surprising. And they fund and inspire al-Shabaab. And I just don't understand why we continue to call the Saudis our allies if in the war on terror, in this era of ideological terrorism, it would seem to me that you can't win militarily, you have to win with a counter-ideology, don't you?
I certainly agree with that, and I think if you trace the origins of this whole radical ideology, it goes back actually for 200 years, at the same time George Washington was advocating the Declaration of Independence and its great themes of universal respect for human opinion, that at the same time in Arabia there were the opposite ideology was being espoused. And so you can trace that origin throughout. But I think that what is very interesting is without an ideological construct, there could not be these kinds of terror attacks. I mean, if you go to a young man in Pakistan and say to him, or in Somalia, I want you to just go and kill indiscriminately civilians, innocent people, most of them would say, you know, why should I do that? I don't want to do that. But if you say to them, there is a provocation of the drone strikes on the other side and all of this, then there would be a response, yes, I'll go and fight for that ideology. So it works both ways. And so the more militaristic the response is, the militarized response, then the asymmetrical terror tactics come into being. And it reminds me of Hercules fighting the Hydra, which had so many heads, 100 heads, he had to crush each one of them at a time. It's like when you attack one place, you may spring 100 enemies. And I think it has to be fought on the ideological front, as you've said.
So the al-Shabaab, who follow the Wahhabi version of Islam, which, you know, the Saudis have used an enormous amount of their petrodollars to propagate their ideology and capture an awful lot of Islam around the world, and the royal family uses religion as a way to hold on to power. They're free to have a decadent lifestyle in the West and live behind these huge palaces and do God knows what. But meanwhile, outside those walls of the palaces, the religious police keep the entire society oppressed through the most stringent rules and regulations that oppress the people to the point where they can't even think beyond religion in order to become even political, and that nobody can vote in that country, or all they can do is depend upon the largesse of the king if they're lucky enough to get an audience. So that's the
I think if you follow the money, that would be a very interesting theme, as you have mentioned. And in Pakistan in particular, the Deobandi madrasas are multiplied and have over a number of years. But if you go back and look at the British occupation of the Indian subcontinent, that they were fighting the extremists in the same areas that these incidents are happening now. So there is a long tradition of a very militant ideology in that part of the world that is perhaps connected with the original extremism, but it certainly takes its own form in each of these countries.
Well, I'm wondering, though, since the Saudi money behind a lot of this, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, et cetera, what they've targeted in Pakistan, and particularly in the Swat Valley, and what Al-Shabaab has targeted in Somalia are the Sufi shrines, which they've destroyed in both countries.
And exactly, yes. And the Shia in Badakhshan, which is an area of Pakistan.
And they routinely murder Shia in Pakistan. So I guess my question is, as a counterweight, since you have to deal with ideology and not this idea that you can kill your way out of this problem, which the U.S. seems to have,
right?
That's a road to hell. But what about the idea that you could somehow revive Sufism to neutralize Wahhabism? Is there a strategy there?
I think that it's, by its nature, a weaker, more philosophical kind of approach. And the Sufis are growing in strength in certain areas. In Turkey, there's a very strong movement. But certainly not sufficient. It's always been a minority in Islam, and not sufficient to challenge the reigning ideologies, and I think particularly young people who are unemployed or underemployed are attracted to muscular ideologies and are easily led into these kinds of things. But I think you're right when you say that the money does a great deal of mischief, and it's easy for people to give money to those kinds of extremist organizations and yet say, my hands are clean. And that really has been something that the U.S. government has tried to track. Whether successfully or not, I think, is debatable.
Well, the only people that we know that give money to al-Shabaab is the country of Eritrea. And they seem to support al-Shabaab because their rival and enemy, Ethiopia, supports the Somali government.
Exactly. And my experience in Eritrea is that the government there is extremely repressive, and they have no, I mean, it's a Marxist government. They have no particular love for Islamic extremists, but they do have their own reasons for doing supporting al-Shabaab. And it means that not just East Africa, which is very convoluted in its politics, and I think the fact that these people struck in Nairobi means that they are intent on exporting the violence to the cross borders in that area, and you can expect to see more of these kinds of things. That's only in East Africa. If you go to the sub-Saharan Sahel in the West, you'll find that Mali and the other countries are also disturbed by these kind of ideological issues. But I think the people who really know most about Africa keep pointing out that if you just look at the terrorism as a symptom and try to crush it, you're not looking at the whole picture, and it cannot be successful. It has to be partly political, partly ideological, partly economic approach to deal with these kinds of things, you know, before they get to the point of such radical extremism.
Well, of course, we were goaded into an endless war by this hopeless fanatic, Osama bin Laden, and the Bush administration literally played right into his hands, right into his playbook. They fulfilled what he was saying, is that the Christian armies want to come and invade your country. So George Bush obliged by sending Christian armies in invading Muslim countries. And isn't that at the heart of this notion of falling into a strategy? In other words, the bin Ladens of this world want a clash of civilizations, don't they? And there are right-wing nuts on our side, too, and racist Islamophobes who also want a clash of civilization. But
yes,
that's the trap, isn't it?
And it was very distressing to see the rush to war that the Bush administration, using the neocon playbook, neoconservative playbook, was very eager to get involved in that and brought the biggest percentage of American population along with them. It would be hard to find American people right now who claim that that was the right action. But those of us who opposed the war from the beginning saw that, just as you said, this horrible scenario was unfolding, and the like a sumo wrestler being pushed off balance, the U.S. as a giant government fell right into the trap. And if you measure what the economic impact on the United States has been, not just even considering the military, the bin Laden strategy was brilliantly successful.
Well, just in closing, James Jennings, what's your sense then of whether we're going to have a more enlightened policy? I mean, once states fail, it's pretty hard to put them back together again. I mean, God knows how much we spent in the last 11, 12 years in Afghanistan, but there's not much to show for it. And Somalia, of course, is even worse, and the destruction there is so nihilistic, as far as I understand, that the al-Shabaab, you know, poison wells, they destroy infrastructure. There's something psychotic and crazy about what's going on. So how do you reverse that?
That's exactly right. I think that all I can say is that you've described a part of the problem, but it's even maybe bigger than that, which is more a pessimistic outlook. And that is, there's an Arab proverb that says, a fool threw a stone into a well, 100 wise men could not get it out. The problem is maybe bigger than that, because once the U.S. has imposed sanctions on countries like Iran, then it's very difficult to retrieve those sanctions. And now the Treasury Department has had its own war against, economic war against Iran and North Korea, and they're going using powers outside of government and much more extensive and beyond government. Once you get those economic sanctions by all the banking system around the world in place, it's very difficult to reverse them. So I see a spiral, and I see the war lasting for a very long time. I'm sorry to be pessimistic about that, but you're right. I think that the Bush administration were eminent fools to rush in where angels fear to tread.
Well, James Jennings, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 to 2011 in the refugee camp on the Ethiopia-Somali border, as well as in the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed at suicide bombings at the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. Since founding Conscience International in 1991, he has demonstrated conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about diplomatic possibilities behind the scenes at the UN.
Messages, victims and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. 'Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a conscience.